What a pleasure. I love Nashville too. It's fantastic. And I want to thank you for being, she's a wonderful host. And Steve Lee, my friend, thank you for thinking of me and the convention people for what, I've just had a ball. I love Nashville. And I'll tell you why. Because it's significant to me. Well, first of all, I just to tell you, like, what happened yesterday, I wanted to say that I had breakfast with some old friends. I used to live here in the 80s, in 1984, 85, which I call the Dark Ages. Yesterday, I met some old friends, and we had breakfast, and then Amy took me to the river, and her husband's got a spot by the river and totally navigated that whole riverfront fireworks thing for us. And I took my tall, my medium, and my small, and my fella. We all went with Quan was there. And I had never seen such a spectacular fireworks show ever. If you saw it, it's amazing. And I got, like, choked up because I feel like Nashville is so, like, it's so colorful to me now. And it wasn't in the Dark Ages. It was bleak. And now it just is like, it's so full of joy. And the difference between now and in the 80s, you know, when I first got here, I managed to, and this, I'm not the humble brag, but I did manage to talk myself into having a record deal. I'm an actress. And I had, like, some tapes of songs, and I slipped it to the A&R person. They said, well, I'm going to take you to Nashville, and you can write songs with people. And I thought that was fantastic. I get to Nashville, but I have this secret in me. I'm about 22 years old, and I got this big secret, which is if I take that first drink, I don't know where that's going to go. I never could follow that through. Once alcohol touches my lips, I end up in a blackout, is usually what happens. And so I have this secret, and here I am coming to Nashville, and I'm going to work with songwriters. This is so fantastic. And I just kind of white-knuckle it, and at night I'm counting. I'm being very careful, very careful. And then the last night I was here, the A&R girl and I, we went to the Exit Inn, and we see a rock band, and she's like, let me get you some tequila, and I drink some tequila, and she's like, I get the bass player, you get the guitar player, you know, and it's all woohoo, fun and games, but now remember, I got this secret, and the next morning, I'm at the Vanderbilt Plaza Hotel, and just like, I don't know how that happened, you know, there's somebody here, and I get on that plane and I do what we do. I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to do that. I lucked out. I'm going to come home. I'm going to be okay. Now, here's the big secret. I grew up in Santa Barbara in beach culture. And I have brothers and sisters. I'm one of five and they're tan and blonde and beautiful. And I'm not saying this is why I'm an alcoholic, but this is how I felt growing up. I was freckled and pale, and I felt like I was funny looking, and that if you really got to know me, you weren't going to like me. Something was deeply wrong with the way I think. And so I started to, I get like a bag of tricks, right? And I think, well, if I sing a lot, I sang in my church choir for years and people seem to respond to that, maybe then they'll like me, right? So I put that in the bag of tricks and nope, that's not enough. Okay, I'll be an actress. That's like Christmas tree lights on my head. Look at me, look at me, look at me. Maybe then they'll like me. Put that in the bag of tricks. Nope, that doesn't feel like it's like I was Teflon, like I couldn't feel it. And I was the girl that had a crowd of people around me, but I felt alone. I felt misunderstood. And I don't know why, but that's just how I felt. And so I kept trying to put things into this bag of tricks until I was in junior high school and discovered beer. You know, I was in Sun Valley, Idaho, and I found another teenage alcoholic, and we got someone to buy us some booze, and we sat on the picnic table by the Circle K, and I drank some beer, and I looked up at the streetlights, and there's a halo around it, And I felt warm. And you know what else was incredible? I felt pretty. I felt her. She had a brother, and he kissed me. And so now I'm like, hey, 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 this is kind of working. You know, and I'm in junior high school, and now, and people are thinking I'm funny, and like it's really working for me. So what do we do when you got that combination of a person who, I was a little girl, like a lot of our family pictures, I took a Sharpie to my face because I didn't think I was pretty. And you know, it saddens me sometimes when I think about that, because I was a cute kid. We're just, you know, we're most, all of us, we're pretty cute in our weird way. But what kind of self-obsession thing did I have going on in the third grade that I got to do that, you know? Kind of gives me compassion for who I was as a little kid. So now I got this beer thing, and then my eyes start to open up, and I see that, you know, because I'm from beach culture, so a lot of marijuana, and my brother's dealing pot now. There's pot plants on my roof. My mom has, this was what I believe to be my family tragedy. She is an alcoholic. I call like a faceplant alcoholic. She was like a fabulous mother all day long, fantastic, fantastic. She cooked dinner and she poured vodka in the coffee cups on the shelf. So while she's cooking dinner, she'd just take a little shot. And we all knew it. We'd watch her just like, you're not fooling anyone because you're hammered, you know, right? And she'd sit down, everything's fine, everything's, you know. She'd pass out. That's how I grew up. It was, you know, and so if you grew up watching your mom like that, what do you say? You say, I am never going to be like her. I am never going to be like her. And so there I am, like in junior high, still I'm not like her. I don't become despicable or weird or sloshy or strange, right? So then I carry on filling up that bag of tricks, right? So because I got to find other things for you to like me, right? So I'm just feeling, I'm getting kind of better at singing and better at acting, and I'm getting still more accolades, but I'm feeling still more empty and empty and empty. And my family explodes, as do families of alcoholics. You know, I come home one day and there's no furniture in my house. So I go live with my sister. She's my oldest sister. She was probably 24, 25 at the time. I was about 16. And she, her boyfriend was a big cocaine dealer, so that's part of my story, though booze is my baby, right? Booze is my baby, but that's part, I used to think cocaine was like the blackout antidote, you know? So I was always trying to, you know, frankly, I don't know if I'd stand up here today if I didn't have blackouts. Like, they scared me to death. Because also, I feel like I'm shy on the inside and spastic on the outside, you know, inside, shy. And those blackouts, I did become like another type of person. Like I would get these phone messages the day after, never check your messages after a bender, because there's nothing good going to come of that. You're like, oh. You know, and I was like hiring housekeepers, which I don't, you know, I didn't need. And like, I'm ready to apply for that job. I remember I had like 8 applications to be my housekeeper. I was broke, like, I don't need a house. I guess I was on some I need a housekeeper bend. I don't know. Who knows? So I'm in high school, and then now I'm starting to get these blackouts. And now my sister's getting worried about me, and people are disappointed in me. And I still got this. Now my bag of tricks is getting bigger and bigger, getting more attention. Yeah, but look what I got. I got all of it. You can't say I'm a loser. Look at this big, full bag of fancy stuff right here, right here. I go down to Los Angeles, and I guess I went to USC. I was on the freshman access program because I didn't have good grades. It's like this program for football players. I'm the first actress that got into the program. So my grades weren't all that up to par. And anyway, 3 weeks into it, I try out for this movie and I get the movie. So now my ego is just, now it's just the booze and the coke and the ego. Now it's like, wait, I did this. And now I'm starting to believe my own, maybe I am maybe I am special, you know, which is really a tricky place for our people to be, I'm telling you, because the guy who gives the snacks, a craft service guy, cocaine dealer, you know, it was a disaster, you know, and I do this job, and now all I got to do is keep that secret at bay, right? Because my quote-unquote dreams are coming true, so I got to keep the secret at bay that I got this thing in me. Because those blackouts still gnaw at me. And I'd get them whenever it was like Friday night and we'd go out. Still not that bad yet. Until finally I go out for a night of festivities and it's fiesta in Santa Barbara. And I last thing I remember was a limbo, doing the limbo. And the next thing I know, shaklank. You know, and I got arrested. I crashed my car, and I decided that really I'd come to terms with what the problem was, which was California. So, you know. So I packed up my Jeep Grand Wagoneer, and I decided that I need to go to Texas where the real people are. And I grabbed my friend. She's like, she had issues too. She's one of us now, ladies and gentlemen. And I pull her out of the crack house, put her in the front seat with me, and we drive through West Texas with a cooler of beer, and she liked the wine coolers, classy. How stupid is that, you know? And we're going through, we see the, what are those, you know, the lightning, the northern lights? We saw that, we're like, aliens, oh my God, there's an alien. We couldn't get any radio stations. That was aliens. And I get to Austin, and she flies home, and I find this other guitar player girl, and I move in with her, and I get this call from, her name's Robin, and I get this call from Robin, and she's like, this may be like a few weeks later, she says, you're not going to believe where I am. I said, where? She said, Betty Ford. I was like, oh! She had gotten intervened when she had landed home after our Texas trip. And her mom put her at the Betty Ford Clinic. And she said, you're not going to believe this, but you know those sparkly-eyed freaks at the AA meeting? And I said, yep, because that's what she and I had a joke about, the sparkly-eyed freaks. And which are you people? No, sorry. She goes, those sparkly-eyed freaks are really cool, and they're smart and funny. I've never had so much fun. You know, and she's telling me about the water polo at the Betty Ford, and I was like, that's crazy. Anyway, I told her, I was like, well, I'm glad that's good for you, but, you know, and I don't maintain very well, but I got some good drinking in me, you know, so I'm good. But then I turn around and I'm in Texas, right? And I feel suddenly surrounded by losers. Like, I'm like immediately surrounded by what I call, you know, like I'm a loser magnet, right? Why do all the losers hang out with me? You know? Why? So, I gotta get out of here, you know? So, I pack up the Jeep Grand Wagoneer and I tell my friend Robin, I say, you know where I gotta go? I gotta go to Nashville. That's where the real people are. So I come back to Nashville, drive the Jeep Grand Wagoneer back to Nashville. And still got stuff going on, right? I still got that record deal. I'm writing songs now, and I meet up with what I call the professionals. Like, these are people that drink. These are people that wake up in the morning. We write songs till about 1 or 2. Right, Em? That's my friend, Em. I love her. We write songs like 1 or 2. We go to Faison's. We drink, right? Then we get kind of tired of that, come back, stumble home on 21st Avenue, and we just write some more songs. And then we go out at night and just drink and see where the night took us, and the whole group of us did this, and it was simultaneously like it was I felt like a rock star, and you know, kind of like I was invested in being a tough chick, you know. I didn't want them to know I was from Santa Barbara, drama geek, you know, like I want to be a rock star, man, you know, like, so I just decided to do what we do. I just acted like one. Hey, man, smoke a cigarette, you know. I'm going to be a rock star. I didn't even know who Keith Richard was at the time. That's how dorky I was. You guys introduced him to me, you know. And so I lived this kind of life, and it was very dramatic and exciting for me. And I got this thing called alcoholism. And I can't keep it. I can't do it. So I'm trying to drink like the boys, but I'm blowing it every night. Now I'm doing it every night. And now my friend, my good friend, she's like, you know, why don't you just drink beer? And I was like, that is great. That's a great idea. I have a couple of beers. So, but I can't have a couple of beers. Then they say, why don't you have a couple glasses of wine? Good. Good. I'm going to do a couple glasses of wine. I can't do that. You know, I will go right back into vodka. Vodka, 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 vodka. That's what I like. You know, I don't know why, but that's just where I always ended up, in the bottom of a martini glass, double olive up vodka. That was my guy. You know, so I'm living this life. Now I'm getting consequences. Now it's starting to really hit me. And one morning I, you know, roll out of bed at like the crack of 1 in the afternoon, right? Oh, you know. Cigarette, and it was at Jay's house, and I come out of the room, and sitting in the living room was this guy, like about 4 or 5 guys, but this one guy in particular, he had tattooed sleeves and long stringy hair and chipped teeth, and he's got a big gulp cup and a bottle of vodka pop off, right, pouring it in that big gulp cup. This 1 in the afternoon. Now I got a head full of, because I, you know, with that DUI, I had to go to those 6 AA meetings, you know, right? So it's in there. The sparkly-eyed freaks are in there a little bit, like, gnawing at my head. And I know if you're drinking vodka out of a big gulp cup 1 in the afternoon on a Tuesday, there's a high likelihood things are not really happening for you in the old career department, or, you know, the old, you know, being an eligible bachelor world, right? So he's pouring that vodka into that cup, and I walk in the room, and he like does a, he has a stringy greasy hair, and he's like a like that, right? And I was like, dude, man, you're drinking vodka out of a big gulp cup at 1 in the afternoon, you're a loser. And he, you know, does one of these like, he's like, man, at least I ain't doing heroin. And I look at him, and I'm just like, oh, my God, you are perfect for me. I love you. You're perfect. I love you. So 2 weeks later, this is a true story. Emma, God is my witness. We are at the Music Row Wedding Chapel in Nashville. I am in a red leather mini dress with platform boots on. I don't know what year that was. Bad. Anyway, drinking. We had a thing like, we're going to eat like kings, you know, make love like rabbits, and drink like fish. Woo! You know, and I think that was our whole. Lovely. But this is my best thinking. This is me, like, love. This is love. I found it, you know. And so I guess I get a movie in North Carolina. I come back. This dude's pawned everything I owned. Like, it's gone. It's like, that's not in the movie of the week, you know. That's not in the script. And after kind of trying to fight it here, I lost a lot of friends, you know, burned a lot of bridges. I told him that I knew exactly what the problem was, and what we really needed to do was go to California, because Nashville was the problem, you know. So we pack up we can't pack up the Jeep Grand Wagoneer, because I set it on fire, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. I set it on fire. It blew up right by that parking lot right on 21st that my car blew up. So but remember, so I had this bag of tricks still, so I had some dough because I keep getting work, right? So that work thing really, as an actress, right? I don't have a problem. I got these jobs. I've got this stuff. So I get a new car, right? So I'm okay. So we get in that car. Everything's good. Just a little memory loss at the end of every evening now. That can happen. Amnesia happens, you know? So we drive out to California. And we decide to start clean there. We're gonna do the deal. And I get to California, and I get back into the swing of things. I'm preparing to go. I get another gig, and I'm putting my makeup on, and I hear a thump in the living room, you know. And I come back out, and my husband's sort of curled up into the bookshelves, and I think he's playing with the cat. So I kind of tip his shoulder back, and he is blue in like a grand mal seizure. And this, and like foam, it felt violent. And if you've ever seen it, the reptilian part of your brain is just like, wah! And I called 911. If you're Al-Anon, the Al-Anon person, this is what I call the Al-Anon cocktail, because I gave him mouth to mouth, and I watched the color come back into his face, just like. And by the time that had all happened, there's a knock on the door, cops coming. He's like, "Man, what did you do?" You know, and he didn't know what had happened. So, and I'm like, "Sit down, this is terrible. Oh my God, oh my God." And we go to the hospital. I tell all the doctors that he is an epileptic and probably in need of medication. So he comes back with these meds for epilepsy. I can't believe they believed that. They must not have. I mean, if you'd seen him, the two of us, I had all the different colored hair, and we were a train wreck. And we come back to the house, and a limousine pulls up, and I say to my ex-husband, I say, "You know, I don't think I can do this anymore. I don't want this life. This is too scary." So I get into the limousine, and the limo driver says, "There's beer back there. I'll just have one." Right? So I cracked that beer open. I had a very harrowing afternoon, you know. And I drink that beer, and then I think, I'm just going to have a couple beers. Who cares? Two beers. I don't know, somewhere between the limo, the plane, I used to drink Jack and soda. I put the swizzle sticks in the buttonholes, you know. I had a whole jacket full of swizzle sticks. Classy. And I got to New Jersey to do this movie, and I don't remember getting picked up. They hold a sign that says Will Hoyt on it, you know, so you kind of just have to go like, me, actress, you know, they sort of wheel you around. So I guess I get back to the hotel, and I have a hazy recollection of getting to the lobby, and there's an elevator to go up to my room, and there's a bar, and I'm standing there, and the sparkly-eyed freaks in my head are saying, "Just go up to your room, baby. You've had a long day. Just take a little nap, take a little breather." And the bar is talking to me. And I have no AA. I have no program. I just have my bag of tricks is getting flimsy. There's a hole in it by this time, right? I just go into that bar. And so for me, we do this thing. If you're new, we do a thing where we tell you what happened. And Steve, you said it so beautifully when you said, "If I'd have known I'd be up at a podium talking about my story, I'd have spiced things up a little bit." What happened? Somebody knows what happened. I wasn't there, but I was there. Anyway, I woke up the next day, and there were, it's a weird story. Well, okay. There were like Kotex all over my bed. I don't use that. All over, like bags of it. Like it was very strange. Watered down vodka by my bed. And I knew the jig was up. I knew I'd blown it, and the message light blinking. Uh-oh, because I think I was supposed to be for a read-through or something that next day. It was like 11 in the morning. So I call my ex-husband. He's like, baby, they don't want you on that movie. Then I start listening to the messages. It's my agents. You're fired. My manager, we don't want to represent you anymore. They kept calling me a loose cannon. So I was a loose cannon with the Kotex cannon. I don't know, you know, like, I don't know. And in my heart, I just kept saying, like, I remember sobbing and just saying, I'm a pretty nice guy. I'm a nice person. I'm not a loose cannon, you know. But I cried. And you know who I called? Robin, my little friend, who joined the Sparkly-Eyed Freaks. And she had called somebody from AA in New Jersey to sit with me. I wasn't ready for that, so I jumped into the car and went to the airport, but I knew it was available to me. And when I got back to Los Angeles, I went to Architects of Adversity at the log cabin. I called the guy at central office. I'm sobbing. You know, you people who work the phones, that's so important. I don't know who I spoke to, but he was sure nice to me. And he told me where this meeting was, right down the street from my house. And you know what? That's an amazing thing to do for somebody who's really ready. I was done. I know where it got my mom. You know, my whole family, alcoholics, drug addicts, their cure was to just not get into the car. That's how you solve alcoholism. Just don't drive. You know, you won't get in trouble. I don't want to live like that. Right? So I said to my husband, I said, I'm gonna go to this meeting. I'm gonna do this AA thing. Cause also my manager had said, if you don't go to AA, I'm not gonna represent you, you know. Now that, you see my tricks, that's my whole identity. If I don't have that, I don't know who I am, right? And then so I walked down the street. I go to this meeting and they said, talk about your last 5 days. I raised my hand. And I stand up, as newcomers do, they don't know, right? I'm that guy. And I said, I have had a terrible time. I got fired from a movie in the world's smallest violin in Los Angeles, let me tell you. And people aren't really that sympathetic to you're getting fired off of a movie. Poor baby. Keep it moving. I spilled more than you drank, honey, you know. So my husband almost died. And then somebody says, well, who are you? Who are you? I'm just Kathleen, a musician. Who are you? And then I said, and I am an alcoholic. And it resonated in me, in like my bone marrow. I identified with it. And I looked at you people, the sparkly eyes. And you saw me. You knew me. And I knew you. And the secret was out. And at the time, I was deeply ashamed. Deeply. It hurt me to say those words. I'm like my mom. That old lady used to tell me how selfish and ugly I am. I'm a her. I'm that like her. But there was something extremely liberating about that, right? When we come to terms with that. That's when I started my journey. The chicks came up to me, gave me their phone numbers. I had like little scraps of paper in my purse. And I walked back up to my little house. And I started. I started the road. I started the journey. I didn't care about this guy. You know, my ex-husband would put, he always wore his underwear on his head with his hair out of the legs. I'm like, you do what you need to do, my friend. I'm going to do the AA thing for a little bit. I'm going to try this. So I just started to go. I just started to go to meetings, see people like you there, you know. And then I saw this woman that I had worked with years before. She was much more successful than me. And she said, look, you need to get a sponsor and get a meeting directory. I said, sure, I'll do what you need to do. I just want to do the 12 steps. So I'm just interested in doing the... Those things. I'm going to do those steps and then, you know, and she's like, great, just do the 12 steps. I said, but here's the thing. You're very kind to me. I don't want you to get close with me because I'm not quitting drinking. I'm not going to quit. I'm going to do the 12 steps, take the heat off, and then I'm going to drink. I'm not going to Ireland someday and not drinking a beer. That's just cuckoo town. I'm not going to Italy and not having a glass of wine. I will not do that. And I'm real defensive, right, how we are when we come here, right? And here's what's so beautiful about our people. She says, great, just do the 12 steps. All right, then. What are we doing? What do we do? So she gives me a big book. Thunk. She says, why don't you read the doctor's opinion? And then I want you to write the history of your drug and alcohol use. And I want you to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and call 3 sober alcoholics a day. I was like, that time. I don't know about you, but I got a lot going on. I can't do this like meetings every day. That's crazy. I got auditions. I got lunch dates, fabulous things, you know. And she works more than me, and she's like, I managed to do it. You just go ahead and do it. You said you wanted to do these 12 steps. This is how we do it. Whatever, crabby pants. She wasn't very, she wasn't very sensitive to me at that time. But I liked her. You know, I had respect for her. She had it going on. So I did that. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. And here's what I tell my sponsees, because they want to tell. I was the girl that said it was a cult. I thought it, you know, sparkly-eyed freak cult, you know. I was that girl. But here's what happens when you go to 90 meetings in 90 days, is you find out meetings you like. Some meetings you don't like, so you don't go to that one, and then you go to this one. This one's not my cup of tea, and I like that one. But you can't find those meetings that you like until you just go for it and show up. And so I did that new kid in school feeling, and I just did it. And you know what happened? I found my friend Jessie. She's a chick I know from Nashville. Actually, we met in Nashville and then back in L.A., my friend Jessie, and she became what I call my trudging buddy. And we would... we'd be like, what meeting are we going to today? You know, and she was starting her journey. And she and I both, you know, I recommend that if you're new, to just latch on to one of your pals and you get a trudging buddy. It makes things kind of fun. And so here's what happened. Then my sponsor, well, I'm doing these 90 meetings in 90 days now. I'm reading the book and she told me to write a drunkalogue. And I was like, yeah, wait, I got drunk. What's the drunkalogue, you know? And she's like, nope, I want you to get specific and just track the low lights, she said, right? So just track those low. So I started to write it and it didn't look good to me. It looked a lot more extensive than I had minimized it to be, you know? And, and then I read it to her, and again, it was like that feeling of like that surrender when I said, oh, I'm an alcoholic. Well, you read the drunkalogue to another alcoholic, there's like this other like deepening of the spirit, like what you talked about, the, you know, the channel gets a little more clear, right? So now I'm looking at that, conceding to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic, right? So I complete that. And we had this issue about the insanity part of step 2, you know, having God restore you to sanity. I told her I'm not insane and I've never been insane, so I have an issue with that. She sat down and she told me about also unmanageability. That was another thing that I had, like a little, you know, I just, how we do, you know, I wanted the program a little bit. I wanted, if I was going to do it, I wanted to do it right. But I didn't just go, okay, I'm unmanageable and insane. You know, I didn't just totally surrender to it. I had to like work it out for myself. And here's what I love about the way she sponsored me. Like, that's cool too. Just do the 12 steps and you get to come to learn about maybe perhaps your perception of the way you are living your life now with the dude with the hair out the legs on the underwear, you know, and then I had missed plenty of opportunities, boy. You know, you think about that, right? That's something that this program also has allowed me to come to terms with, you know, those missed opportunities for people with big dreams. That can get overwhelming on a bad day of alcoholism, you know. That can hit you like a cold front. You know, what did I do? I shoulda, woulda, coulda. But then what do? We go right back into our prayer and meditation, 11th step, and gratitude. And I don't have to look very far when it comes to gratitude, health, and love. I got health and love. That's a lot. So anyway, back to my steps, so my journey. Because what happened for me is we get to step 3. She's telling me to do the third step prayer. you know, I offer myself to thee, build with me, do with me as thou wilt, blah, right? And then, and she tells me I do this third step prayer for 2 weeks, every day, morning and night. Okay, you know, remember now, I'm going to do these steps and then carry on with my life, right? So I'm like, okay, thee, thou, amen, you know. And so I do this prayer. It's meaningless words to me. It's just lines on a page. It's lines, you know. I do the lines, whatever. But in the meantime, now I'm the cake girl at the Saturday morning strip group, right? And I'm baking cakes for this thing because I still need that, my bag of tricks. Attention, look at me, look at me. You know, so I'm baking these big cakes for this thing. And I'm, you know, it's like exciting for a new person to bake the cake and you give the cakes and you feel important and like you're the cake guy. And if you're not there, then you have to get someone to replace you. So again, not rocket science, not a cult. Like, what does that do? Makes me feel a part of. Nobody was asking me to do anything prior to that. Show up. My agent's begging me, just go, just show up on time, please. But here I am, like, I'm early for this cake thing. And my cakes look good. And so I'm doing this cake thing. My friend and I are having fun. People are asking us to hang out with them at Cantor's afterwards. That's our place we go, right? Remember? And I'm having laughs, sober laughs, which, you know, as a drunkie person, sober laughs feel different, don't they? Sober belly laughs feel different than weird pot filled drunkie laughs, you know. So I'm having laughs and I'm feeling a part of a community. And so she says, you know, it's been 2 weeks, so why don't you come up to my house and we'll finish the third step. I come up to her house. She says, I want you to get down on your knees. I'm like, oh geez, this is it. This is where the sparkly eyed freak thing comes in. I'm gonna get on my knees. She's like, nope, I'm gonna do it too. We're gonna get down on our knees. And she holds my hands. Right? And then she looks at me, you know, our fellow chick-to-chick alcoholic guys, and she says, let's do this prayer together. And she's looking at me, and I can't move my eyes from her gaze, right? And I say, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt, right? And then when I get choked up too, like when I get to relieve me of the bondage of self. Relieve me of the bondage of self. It kills me. You know, like, I felt so like, you know, maybe I will get to be a happy person. Maybe that can happen for me, you know. Because I was so self-obsessed, self-absorbed, and I didn't want to be. I just wanted to bust through like a, you know, guy in a cake. Hello, I care about other people too. I do. And so I like weep, you know, with this prayer, and she said, that's all right. That's what we do. You are not alone. So my whole life, that's my secret. I'm the girl that's alone. Tons of people, we love you. Love you, Kathleen. Love you. Nah, if you knew me, you wouldn't. If you knew what's in my bone marrow, you wouldn't. And now all of a sudden, I think maybe I believed it, right? God. Okay. She says, now you're going to write a list of all the people you're mad at. And it was lengthy. Because a lot of people did stuff that was unfair to me. Because they didn't understand I had incurable sleep disorder, you know. So, agoraphobia. I really felt that I had these things. Agoraphobia, that's my problem, not booze. I just can't, I'm afraid. So anyway, I set out. I start writing this list, and I wrote this whole list, and I excluded my mother and my father. I excluded them because I just felt like she'd tried. She's like, now you didn't have your mom on there. I was like, well, she didn't mean to. She's just a drunk like us. Now I'm getting some understanding and some forgiveness a little bit. You see how that works, son? And I feel so protective of my sweet little mom that I don't even want to put her on the list, you know? But I was, as if you grew up with alcoholism, enraged. You know, enraged. Because what, you know, here's what is tough as a sober alcoholic, a child of a drunk mom, is you think, because AA has just taken a Klieg light, man, and just shine it down on my life. Like, look what you got. You know, like, my life is gorgeous because of AA. And I can't help but think, like, what if my mom got this? You know, what if she got this? How might her life have turned out? Anyway, I end up, because this is what we also do if you're new, is that more will be revealed. So I suggest to sponsors, with my sponsees too, do the best you can is what I tell them. Because, you know, for me, like I said, I was very serious about drinking after that 12th step. Whatever, carry the message. Y'all carry the message and then I'll go drink, right? I was very serious about that. And if she wanted to get into a debate with me about it, I'd have been like, all right, let's go. I'm ready to tell you why. So I but you see how what's happening to me while I'm doing these steps is I'm just softening and I'm forgiving. So I do this fourth step, and she's writing names down off of my fourth step. She's also written my character defects down. Now, I have been sober since 1990, right? 22 years. Now, I didn't get step six and seven, I believe, until about 6 years ago. Didn't really kind of get what that was, but it got really real for me when I started really getting a lot of sponsees. I started speaking more and getting a lot of sponsees. And, you know, I found myself telling him, I said, now you pray to get your character defects away. You just do that seven-step prayer and breathe the fly away, you know, right? But I didn't really understand that until I started to sort of study it. And I didn't study it because anybody told me to. I studied it because I wanted to. I came to AA because I wanted to. That's how we operate ultimately, alcoholics, right? They can strong arm us as much as they want. But ultimately, I needed to call that central office. Nobody forced me to call them that day, you know? I needed to stand up and say, I'm an alcoholic. Nobody forced me. It wasn't because of anybody else. It was all me. So I do the best I can on step six and seven, and she did the best she could in terms of explaining it to me. But what I've come to learn is that it's not rocket science. That if you pray to have God have you good, you know, good and bad, right? Relieve me of my character defects so that I may be of better service to people, right? That makes sense. Because my character defects has to do with pride, my ego, that I gotta still 22 years sober, gotta wrestle that baby down every day. Like, shut up, don't, no, up, you know. It's like, yeah, but I should have been, no, up, you know. I gotta wrestle that girl down. But what happens, and that's why I tell my sponsees, like, it's not rocket science to give God your character defects, because if I think about my ego in the morning when I do my prayer, and I got this whole technique which I recommend, and I'm just going to tell you guys, this is what I do. I have a lot of pillows on my bed. At night, I put them to the side of the bed. In the morning, I wake up, eyes open, I'm an alcoholic, my alcoholic brain starts. You are never going to be, oh, over the hill, and you're kind of weird. I roll out, I got this whole thing, roll out of bed on my knees with my arms on the bed. It's a one move. Boom. And I just, right? And I do this, and I pray, and I pray hard. And, you know, my husband's used to it, my new husband. Life turned out great for me, obviously. The underwear guy, he lives happily ever after he gets sober. This ain't his story, it's mine. So, anyway, I have to do that. That's what I got to do. And the sixth and seventh step has become very meaningful to me. And there's this great book, Drop the Rock. And, you know, I've since, like, you know, been going to 6 and 7 step meetings. You know, it's a deep step when you get into it. And I recommend just kind of, if you're curious at all about it, just go for it, because there's so much great, great literature on those 2 steps. So I'm going to go back. So now my sponsor hands me my list of people that I've, she perceives that I have harmed. And and I say to her the 2 words, but, you know. But as a blackout alcoholic, you don't always know. So the truth is that I ended up just tackling. I had my list, and she had me write down what I, the my part section, which, by the way, when we get into it, like, the my part section is really, for me, been incredibly freeing, especially if you felt like you were a victim your whole life, right? The my part section really is killer, because that's the thing you can control. You know, you've heard about the 4th step, new guys, you've heard about the 4th step, you do these columns, right? It's not as daunting as everyone thinks it is. You just have to sit down and do it. You know, I tell my sponsees, just do your 20 minutes a day. Just sit down and just get it done, because you'll be doing more of them, you know, and you, more people are gonna get on that list. It's a less life. You know, we live life on life's terms. We don't live happily ever after here when we finish those 12 steps. What we do is live happily ever today. Happily today is pretty good, right? And if you stack up a graceful day, right? Just like, I did all right. Because now what happened to my mind with this my part section is now I'm thinking, like, well, you know, my ex-husband, the one with the underwear on his head, he used to say, if you can't make the trip back, don't take the trip out. You know, because I'd always cry the next day of my drunken benders, you know, like, well, I don't know why you didn't just take me out. And he's like, if you can't make the trip back. But it was so applicable to, I think, resentments and life. Because now I can feel it, right? You feel a hot energy. You're getting mad. You can feel the hot, I'm going to law. And, you know, I like to jog. So I jog and I think of these great diatribes. I'm going to nail them, you know, right? And but what I do now is, before I nail him, I pick up the phone, I call my sponsor. She says, why don't you write about it? I write about it. This is on a good day, by the way. This is when it works, if you work it. I write about it, and I get to that my part section, and you get better at recognizing what your part is. You just get better at it. It just comes quick. And sometimes you can do those inventories because your thinking has been really trained. You keep coming to these meetings. You just start really thinking, like, ooh, if I scream at the... Here's what happens. This is a total epiphany that I had. Every time I don't do work the program on my resentments and I decide, why do I always have to be the one that takes it? You know, that's usually the thing. Every time I do that, I am not met with, when I scream and yell at somebody with my great, because it's well thought out, right? I got it nicely, you know, my big, you know, and another thing, right? Right? Every time I do that, I have never once had someone go, you're right. Oh my God, I don't know what I was doing. What was I thinking? Never once. Every time I do my big screaming thing, whatever, I'm met with, like, oh, Jesus, you know, this, like, a horrified, like, you're crazy. That's not what I want. That's not, you're right. That's terrible. And guess what? I feel horrible when I do that. And then I have to make amends for it. Real amends. Because I know that if I do a crappy amends, I'm not free. I have to do real amends all the time when I mess up. So what do I do now? So now the program's working not as a, you know, brainwashed, you know, sparkly-eyed freak. Now I'm thinking about not messing up so hard because I don't want to do that amends. It's so practical. Do you think like normal people had like a meeting, you know, if they all learned this, that if you act decent, you don't have to humble yourself all the time, you know? So anyway, I do these amends and what's my time? I'm sorry. Okay, good. All right, so anyway, so here's what happens. I just finished my story. So you guys know, a lot of you know what the steps are. They're very freeing. I just have to tell you, you start living your life and you start living this program and it's sort of, you practice it. It's just like more of a practice. Just practice. And you're never perfect. But you keep practicing it because it feels good. It's just easier. It's just easier to be a nice guy, be dignified, not be a big ego freak. Then you don't have to feel like a failure if you feel like you were kind to your sponsees today. You didn't fail. You were a nice person. You know, you look in the mirror, like that's what happens, I think, when people get on the pink cloud, is they're not hurting people anymore. They're brushing their teeth and they look in that mirror and they're like, I'm not a bad guy. I'm a nice person. I drove that guy to a meeting. Very simple, but we have this whole setup for us to be of service, for us not to be selfish. I feel so grateful to AA because when I start getting self-obsessed, I don't call people to tell my problems generally. The first thing I do is check in on my sponsees. How are you guys doing? Next thing I know, I forgot about how I was never going to be anything ever, and too fat and too ugly to act, right? Because that's all self-obsession. So I'm going to close with this little thing. So 10 years ago, my mom died. She never got to be sober. And I'm looking through her stuff, how we do, right? She collected some stuff. I'm looking through this stuff, and I find articles written about her, about how she played the saxophone. My mom, what? I mean, I knew she played like marching bands, but we always made a joke about it because she was the drunk chick. She was like in our family, right? We made jokes. But she was a heavy sax player. She played the saxophone in jazz band. She won awards. I find awards and little trophies. And my mom played, you know, big band stuff, right? She's a jitterbug girl. And I find this whole life that she had before our disease, you know, threw her down, you know? And we treated her the way people treat our people when we're in our disease, with no respect. You know what I mean? And I got to live with that. But I remember sitting on her bed, right, when she was dying. It was so bad. But I remember sitting there and saying, that was so awful to you, you know, Mama. I'm so sorry. And she said, well, you made me laugh. You made me laugh all the time, honey. You were pretty bad, but you made me laugh, you know. And the tears I have are because she didn't get this. She doesn't get to see colorful Nashville and fireworks and green trees and music and life, you know. She got to go to work, come home, drink, get drunk, everyone yells at me, now I fall asleep, now I go to work, drink, get drunk. For years. And I'm saying, go be free. You are here. Let's go be free and let's carry our message because it's good. Thank you.